The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, the BBC's science and environment correspondent talks oil spills and reporting on climate change.
I think where collectively the media probably haven't really done the public a service is by explaining the range of uncertainties that scientists always attach to their work.
On the 10th anniversary of the first draft of the human genome sequence, a Nobel Prize winner tells us why patenting genes would inhibit research and prevent patients being able to afford treatment.
American women are still having to pay something like $4,000 for familial breast cancer testing. This is simply not available to the poorer quarter or so of American women who don't have health insurance, and they simply have no way of checking whether they have these faulty genes or not, and are therefore liable to die of breast cancer. And this seems to me absolutely iniquitous.
We use the Guardian's story tracker to dissect a new study looking at the links between mobile phone masts and cancer risks in children.
The survey that came out on Thursday that was talking about some 46% of Europeans still concerned or very concerned or fairly concerned about the health risks.
Plus, what happened when the geeks invaded The Guardian for a weekend?
There was a beautiful device called the auroroscope, which is a physical thing built with soldered metal and LEDs that would light up to indicate auroral activity on the globe.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. The Guardian's Nell Bowes is here in the studio, as is the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee. We'll be hearing from them in just a moment. We'll start with the BBC's David Shookman, though. He's their science and environment correspondent, and he's travelled to all ends of the world for his job. In his new book, Live from the End of the World, he reports on the weird, wonderful, and woeful things about our planet, and what we humans are doing to it. He wasn't always into environment and science, though, and started his career as a foreign reporter. He came into the studio earlier to tell us why he changed.
Very naively, I stepped into a job which I thought would, the principal merit of which would be that I wouldn't get shot at anymore. I sort of lost my nerve, basically, with foreign reporting, conflict reporting. Yeah. And I had a sort of, one significant kind of Rubicon moment in Tajikistan when there was the chance of going into Afghanistan, and I thought, no, I'm just not going to do that. So I was casting around for what else to do, and this editor came up with this job of environment and science. Now, I first thought that meant kind of fish quotas, farming, both of which I'd had my fill of as Europe correspondent covering Brussels. Yeah. And then I thought, with the science, you know, I've always enjoyed science. I've always read the science pages of the papers. I've usually read New Scientist. I've kept up with it. But in television terms, I couldn't quite see it. It felt to me like labs and test tubes and kind of how would you make it interesting? And then this editor said, look, hang on, it's anything you can see on the cover of National Geographic magazine or imagine seeing on the cover. Mm. It's rainforests, glaciers, pollution, it's whatever. And various friends and family said, look, don't be a prat, do it. And I started it, and I still wasn't quite sure, You know, was it the sort of item about some endangered fluffy animal at the end of the bulletin? Was it some quite complicated scientific breakthrough that editors felt they ought to do but never quite understood or really wanted? And then I suddenly realised, sort of a year or two into the job, that actually this thing had political momentum. I hadn't clocked that at all. I mean, I obviously knew about global warming and all the rest of it, but I'd never really understood it as a political issue. And suddenly found, sort of during the first year or two, that there were these very major scientific research projects that were being published in the big journals. And I thought, well, I didn't know that. And I went to editors and said, look, did you know all this stuff about Greenland, for example, or Antarctica, or did you know about the Amazon? And they said, no, we haven't heard that either. Why don't you go and do it? And I then sort of found myself in a role which was completely unplanned, where I just thought, if there's peer-reviewed published science on an interesting topic that I don't really know about, and editors will fund me to go and report on it, and it makes good telly, I'll go off and do it. So I sort of found myself, month after month or whatever, coming up with stories from ever more outlandish parts of the world. And I almost thought, and editors are going to say, hang on, you're pulling a fast one here. And they didn't. They kept saying, yeah, actually, we'll have more of that.
It sounds like a dream job. I mean, you go around the world to places where you don't get shot at. You go to the nice bits this time, the National Geographic cover. I mean, any favourites from the pages there?
Well, I mean, there are the sort of favourites in what was the most spectacular kind of experience, which I guess would have to be visiting the British Antarctic Survey in Antarctica at a place called Rothera. They've got this base down there on the Antarctic Peninsula. And anyone who goes there has to go through safety training. And I thought, well, we haven't got much time. You know, I haven't got time for to arse around with safety training. But they took us up onto the ice sheet, which at that part is about a quarter of a mile thick. It was an amazing concept in itself. And there are these crevasses in it. And it's crevasse training. To familiarise yourself with a crevasse, they actually teach you to abseil, and then you abseil down into the crevasse. Now, again, I thought, this is a bit of a waste of time. We should be filming, filming research and science and stuff. But my cameraman and I abseiled down into this crevasse, and the cameraman went first, Tony Forshaw, and the first thing I heard echoing back up to me on the surface was a string of swear words. And I thought, what's all that about? So I climbed down. I'm not very good at abseiling. You've got to pull this little lever and whatever. You've got the crampons on. I was a novice at this. But I found myself in a place of staggering beauty because the ice is blue.
Yes.
And you've got the light coming not just down from the crack in the ice above you, but because of a weird sort of process of fractures in the ice, the light also comes into the crevasse sideways. And even from below. So it's like walking into an aquarium with these different blues and these amazing formations of ice and these icicles. And it's like the closest analogy was when I first dived and went down through the water and arrived at a coral reef, which was a sort of blizzard of staggering colour and life. And it was a bit like that. You're suddenly in this magical realm. And I was really intoxicated by it. And we did no filming for hours because Tony and I were just gobsmacked.
Well, that's what the swearing was about the beauty of it was.
The sheer swearing. And the guides with us just smirked at each other because they'd seen that reaction from everyone before. It was no big surprise to them that we were just completely blown away.
I noticed from that section of the book that you had your whiskey with a chunk of glacier ice. I've done that. I did that Svalbard. It's fantastic.
It's an amazing experience.
Because the ice is compacted and there's little kind of molecules of gas bubble out when it cracks. And as a way to drink Glenlivet, I've got to say.
It tasted better, even if there's no scientific reason for that. But it... Because we were there on Burns Night.
Oh.
And for some reason, Scots are drawn to these polar regions.
Because no one else will have us.
Well, no one. Well, we suddenly found ourselves, Burns Night taken very seriously. Mm. Fellows in kilts, and there was a haggis and the whole procedure, and million-year-old ice cracked into our whiskey. But there you are, you've got this sort of South Pole blizzard blazing away outside, and the wind tugging at the Union Jack and all the rest of it. And you think, I'm a 6-hour flight south of the Falklands. And here we are dancing reels. It was a completely surreal experience.
That's just wonderful. I can understand that one. Northwest Passage, that's another one of your journeys. Nell, you were sort of intrigued by that.
I wanted to hear. I have a slight yen to go through the Northwest Passage myself and wondered how it was. Why were you going through it?
Well, what happened was that in September 2007, there was this record melt in the Arctic. I mean, the sea ice retreats every summer and regrows every winter, no big deal. But this year it melted way beyond expectations. And the European Space Agency looked at the satellite pictures and said, hang on, there's no ice at all in the Northwest Passage. There's sort of waterways that get you through from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And editors sort of said, that's a good story. Mm. So we did a quick turn in the studio that night, and then they said, actually, that's not enough. We want you to go through it. And I worked with a great producer, Mark Georgiou, who we had some contacts in Canada, and by incredible good fortune, he got hold of this professor who was in charge of research on a ship going through the Northwest Passage. And three people had just pulled out an hour before Mark's phone call. And they said, well, how quickly can you get out there? And we charged straight out there. We were three of us, cameraman, me and producer. And we got way up to this little Inuit settlement, Resolute, population 200. It's dry because there's a very high crime rate and all kinds of social problems.
Actually,
the dryness was a bit of a problem for us because actually you kind of, the one thing you really need is a drink. But anyway, it was quite tricky to get. And then the ship turned up and it was a Canadian Coast Guard icebreaker refitted for science with 40 researchers on board. And it was called the Amundsen after Roald Amundsen, who was the first to navigate the Northwest Passage at the start of the last century. And there's no harbour at Resolute. It's too small. So they picked us up by helicopter. And we flew over the stretch of water, landed on the ship. We were made very welcome. And I suddenly realised, actually, that the word passage, you know, you imagine a narrow channel. Actually, these are quite big stretches of sea. I mean, parts of the Northwest Passage are 100 miles across. Mm. And my heart sank because I'm not very good on boats. I get seasick. And I'd imagined, oh, I'll be all right on this one because of these passageways.
Yeah, so there won't, there won't be
any waves to know. As the helicopter landed on the deck, I thought, actually, there are waves. B, you know, I can't see the other shore because the channel's so wide. And I'm committed to an unknown period of time because what we didn't know was how long the expedition would take and quite where we'd get off the other end. I mean, there were various plans.
Yeah.
But we set sail and we were, this was perhaps the most moving experience because we were a community, 20 crew, 40 scientists, us three. We were a community that was completely isolated, very purposeful, very dedicated. The scientists really going out in all weathers to do their stuff. We were working like crazy to file the multimedia world. I was blogging and the satellite links didn't always work, but we did a bit of telly as well and some radio. And there was just this fantastic atmosphere. There was this sense of diligence about the science, passion on the part of the crew, loving the Arctic, you know, and for Canadians, it's a very important part of their heritage and their and politics. You know, they're very touchy about it actually, because you know the Americans keep saying these waters are international and you know we can go through them kind of thing. And for us, you know, I'm sure like you read the history of the Northwest Passage, all these explorers who died there, and you know, and we were sailing over waters where people had died, you know, and we must have sailed close to or over Franklin's wrecks. And, you know, the first night I couldn't sleep. I was too wired and excited. And one reason I couldn't sleep was that there was this cheeping sound, a sort of loud, pinging, sort of whistling thing every second. And I thought, I was sharing a cabin with the cameraman, and I thought it was one of Rob's gizmos, you know. Yeah. And he was fast asleep, and I rummaged through his gear to try and switch off whatever it was. And I realized this cheeping sound was coming from outside in the corridor, so I stepped out. And then I realized it was coming from this sonar device. Now, they were, with sonar, mapping the seabed of the Northwest Passage. Oh. And I suddenly thought, hang on. You know, think of all those explorers who didn't even have a map. You know, they died trying to find a way through the ice, and we were just barreling along at 10 knots and mapping the seabed in 3D with sonar, and I'm complaining about it. So that shut me up, and I jammed in some earplugs and fell asleep.
You've just come back, I think, from the Gulf of Mexico and the BP spill there. Can you just give a little bit of a feel for the experiences that you had there?
Well, there's a lot of talk about how bad it is. I mean, there's no doubt. I've seen on a boat trip in the Louisiana marshlands how in certain areas the oil has got right in there. You know, it's there are the reeds are stained black, and getting the oil out of that is almost going to be impossible. I reckon they're going to have to just wait for the wave action to sort of drive it out. So it's definitely a catastrophe. In a localized sense, you know, there's all this debate about, is it a sort of regional catastrophe? Everyone's saying it's America's worst environmental disaster. I think I'd probably argue that it's more of a disaster in waiting, because I flew over the edge of the oil slick, and it's multiple slicks. And we flew the 50 miles over the ocean to the spill site, where you've got all the vessels trying to work on stemming the oil. And we flew over a lot of oil. I mean, there's a huge volume of oil out on the surface. And if you look at the various maps and satellite pictures, you can see that the vast bulk of it is still out in the ocean. It hasn't come ashore. It sort of nudges ashore. And so when the Coast Guard talk about it menacing the shoreline, I think that's actually almost a better way to describe it, because it's something it's a problem stored up and being added to, that at any moment could blast on shore and cause real havoc. So what struck me was the scale of the problem. Yeah. It also struck me that actually we haven't seen the worst of it.
David, one of the assignments that you talk about in the book is Copenhagen and covering the Copenhagen climate talks, a famous political disaster. What is your actual perception of climate change? And by that I mean the perception of the public's perception of climate change. Do you feel that despite all the deniers, that there is still a genuine fear in most people that we are damaging the climate system in this world, or are the deniers making progress?
Well, I'm quite confused by some of the opinion polls. I mean, some of the most recent seem to show that, you know, majority of British people, actually, and Americans, sort of recognise that there is a problem with greenhouse gases and global warming. An opinion poll that we conducted earlier in the year, which followed in the footsteps of a Times poll, we asked the same questions 4 months on, showed a massive swing to a more sceptic view of whether man-made climate change is actually a real thing. So, I mean, I would have to say that my own take is that public opinion is perhaps a bit volatile about this. And I don't think it's necessarily been helped by the failures of Copenhagen, by a pretty long cold winter, by the so-called barbecue summer. You know, all these questions about, you know, can the Met Office forecast anything right? Can scientists get things right? Lots of questions about the credibility of science with the email saga and all the rest of it. And I've been sort of looking out to see, well, what is the mainstream science still just saying about this? And from my reading of it is that the majority of it still points to there being a problem if you keep adding greenhouse gases.
Having a look at that sort of majority scientific view, do you feel a duty or a kind of an obligation to report in a particular way or to put a particular slant on your investigations?
No. I mean, I'm a correspondent. I'm not a campaigner in any kind of way. So I hope there's no slant. I mean, there are shed loads of critics who attack me for being slanted, actually in both ways. But
that's
most
always reassuring.
Yeah, and it is. Although it has to be said, most critics think I'm a sort of green apostle. I mean, I just think that the job of anyone doing this work is to try to keep across the main scientific literature, try and rely on what you hope is the most reliable science, and try to report it fairly. And I think where collectively the media probably haven't really done the public a service is by explaining the range of uncertainties that scientists always attach to their work. You know, when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reported in 2007, they came up with a range of possible temperature rises for the coming decades. Now, you know, editors, producers, sub-editors, they want, ideally, the story told as simply as possible. They probably want the upper figure.
Yes.
They want, if it's a range, they want two figures. And we all know that. And the scientists know that. And I don't know whether the public know that. And I think, as we kind of, we're in a slightly different era, actually, of reporting climate now, I think, and in many ways, where I think we need to be more open, actually. It confuses the story, but we need to be much more open about, well, the scientists are saying at the lower end, the temperature rise could only be whatever. And at the upper end, they're only saying there's a 5% chance of that. And that actually the kind of consensus is a range, not one figure, but a range somewhere in the middle. It makes it much more difficult.
Yes, I mean, you're quite right, but trying to convince a news editor that something might happen is no.
Yeah, I want
it to happen.
They want it to happen, and I think
they want the headline.
They want the headline, and I think one of the great problems with and since I've covered a sort of range of environmental issues, you know, a pollution story is a doddle in comparison, because like plastic in the ocean, you know where it's from, you know where it's going, you can see it. It's just a no-brainer.
It's an oily bird somewhere.
Oily bird, just that's, you know, it's easy.
Yeah.
Climate. You're talking about invisible gases that may be building up to cause an effect decades away, and those effects themselves have attached to them a range of probabilities. Yeah. Well, that's quite a mouthful, isn't it?
Yes.
Rather than oily bird.
David Shookman there speaking to Robin McKee and Nell Bowes. David's book, Reporting Live from the End of the World, is out now. Leave your thoughts on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. You can also subscribe to this podcast while you're there.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
My name is Jeremy Keith, and on the weekend of the 19th and 20th of June, I spearheaded an invasion of the Guardian offices for science. The event was Science Hack Day, the first of its kind, and it was a great success. A hack day is basically when a whole bunch of enthusiastic geeks, designers, developers get together for 24 hours to build something, anything, using all the data sets that are out there. So this is the way that a hack day works, is that everyone who's signed up for the event shows up on the morning of the first day, and we begin by having some talks, some inspirational talks, some educational talks to get everyone in the mood. So we had talks from people from Yahoo Developer Network, from the Greenwich Maritime Museum, from the Wellcome Trust, all showing cool projects, somehow science-related, to get people in the mood and give people ideas of what they could build over the weekend. And then, at some point in the afternoon, the hacking begins, and it continues for 24 hours. Now, when I say hacking, that's basically opening up the computer, getting online, and programming, building stuff. Most of the people who come to a hack day tend to be programmers. There were also some designers. And, of course, we had people who were scientists, which was excellent. We had some astronomers there. Some people had traveled as far as away as the Netherlands, which was fantastic. And it was great to see the worlds mixing, that ideas from the science world were going out there to developers who started to build very cool things. And at the end of 24 hours, people either stayed awake during the night or got some sleep, or maybe they went home and got some sleep and came back the next day. But at the end of the 24 hours, everybody presents what they've built in a sort of lightning round fashion. So most of the hacks fell into two categories. There were either tools to do with scientific publications or tools to do with scientific data. So, for example, a lot of the things that were built around scientific publications were tools that made it easier to find scientific papers, made it easier to annotate scientific papers, made it easier to spot the trends in scientific publishing over time. And then the kind of hacks that were built using scientific data were things like astronomy data and showing that on maps and other kind of data from that's coming out of science all the time. There's a lot of big data sets out there, and there's no end to the fun that can be had with them. So, for example, one of the projects that launched out of Science Hack Day was a site called Random Orbit, which is all about plotting satellite data on maps, and is going to make it very easy for anybody to plot satellites on maps and see what satellites are above them right now. And on the scientific publishing side, there were hacks like RefWatcher, which is all about spotting trends in scientific publishing. And then there were some that were just didn't fall into either category. So a couple of hardware hacks. There was a beautiful device called the auroroscope, which is a physical thing built with soldered metal and LEDs that would light up to indicate auroral activity on the globe. And there was another fantastic hack called Open Dirt Map. And that was all about going out and collecting soil samples and analyzing those soil samples, plotting them on a map. Really good fun because people were really getting to the scientific spirit there, running around with test tubes filled with dirt and then measuring the pH value. And there's all sorts of applications that could be fun with that. Social applications, you know, I need dirt of this kind, or it could be a really useful online tool to say something like, well, you should grow potatoes in that soil, or you shouldn't grow anything in that soil because it might kill you. So all sorts of good fun stuff that came out in just 24 hours. You can find the details of all these hacks and more on the Science Hack Day website, which is at sciencehackday.com. And hopefully this is the first of many events of this kind. There's already talk of having more Science Hack Days in more cities. Maybe in October there might be one in Munich. There's talk of having one in San Francisco. Keep an eye on the website, sciencehackday.com.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
10 years ago this week, scientists published the first draft sequence of the human genome. To celebrate, the men behind that project got together at London's Science Museum to reflect on the first decade of the genomic era, and to look ahead to what's next. The event was part of a launch of a new gallery at the museum called Who Am I, which looks at identity from all aspects, genes to culture. We'll hear from Nobel Prize-winning biologist John Sulston in just a moment. First, though, here's Mike Stratton, director of the Wellcome Trust's Sanger Institute in Cambridge, which was one of the main partners in the Human Genome Project back in 2000.
Well, I'm a cancer researcher. I work on the genes that cause cancer. All cancers arise from a single cell that begins to behave badly. It keeps on dividing. It invades tissues around it and can drift off into the bloodstream to form deposits elsewhere. In other words, that's the behavior of a cancer, and all cancers arise because that single cell at their origin has abnormalities in its genome, mutations in its DNA. And so it's been a central aim of cancer research for the last 30 years to find those key genes which are abnormal within cancers and which are driving them to behave as cancers. And that's been a pretty successful enterprise up to the year 2000. But when the human genome draft sequence was announced in 2000, it provided a really completely new strategy to start exploring cancer genomes. And that was a very simple strategy, which is essentially to systematically sequence cancer genomes. Now, initially, we had what we'd now regard as rather old technology to do that. Nevertheless, we and others started doing that, taking a small number of cancer genomes, 20, 30, 40, and sequencing small parts of them. Despite the fact that that was small numbers and small parts, those early days yielded new discoveries, new cancer genes, which are clearly operating to cause a variety of different cancers. And those early discoveries are worth reflecting on for a moment, because we've had 10 years or to exploit them. And what's illustrative about those early discoveries is that some of them have lent themselves to be targets for new drugs. Not all of them, and that's another lesson to be learned, but some of them. And some of them have been the targets of drug development over the last 8 years, finding small molecules which can turn off a gene that has been stuck in the on position by its mutation, making those small molecules into drugs that people can take, putting them into clinical trials, and showing that in a number of cases now, those new drugs, based on discoveries from the human genome sequencing of cancers, are very active in tumor types such as malignant melanoma, which were otherwise completely untreatable.
We're here in the Science Museum in London celebrating the 10th anniversary of the first draft of the human genome back in June 2000. And you are working with the Wellcome Trust to sequence 10,000 genomes now.
So since the human genome draft in 2000, there has been very major developments in sequencing technology. Those really began to hit us in the research context in about 2007. And they're continuously improving. So that now in 2010, we can sequence DNA 10 to 100,000 times faster than we could in 2000, and at the same cost, very important. What that means is that we can now consider sequencing whole genomes of large numbers of people. And that's what the UK 10K The project to sequence the genomes of 10,000 people from the UK is about. Now that, in itself, is an interesting thing for us to think about. The UK has a very strong tradition in the understanding of genomes and genetics, from Darwin to the unraveling of the structure of the double helix, to our contribution to the human genome sequence. Now we're again at the leading edge in understanding differences between individual human genomes and their importance in disease. And as a result of this 10,000 genome project in the UK, 1 in 6,000 people in the UK will have had their genome sequence to contribute to this project.
Looking at the next 10 years of genomic science, are you more excited about that than when the first draft was actually published 10 years ago?
That's a good question. I'd put it in this way. The reason why I'm more excited now, even than I was in 2000, is because we still have the vision, but we now have the tools to implement the vision. And we can see over the next decade how all this information is going to be generated. And we can see quite clearly that by 2020, we will have a more or less exhaustive view of the genetic basis of the large majority of human diseases.
Hi, Alec, I'm John Sulston. I was director of the Sanger Centre or Institute from 1992 till 2000, when we sequenced a third of the human genome. What I didn't imagine was that it would blow up into an enormous sort of myth-generating event, as it did. But in a sense, that was no bad thing, in that it did mean that people got very excited about it, sometimes for the wrong reasons and over-raising of expectations. But nevertheless, it was good, I think. It increased the sort of popular interest in genetics a great deal.
Do you think there were too many hyped cures and potential uses sold to politicians or by the media?
Well, certainly, and I've been checking with people on the 10th anniversary, nobody is saying I did that, and I don't think our consortium did, by and large. I mean, obviously, when you're giving press conferences, it's difficult to always be exactly right. But I think it sort of got enlarged in the telling a little bit. There was a very good reason why it got hyped so much, or actually it's a very bad reason, but I mean the real reason why it got hyped so much was very simply that there was a what became known as the race between a private corporation called Celera and the public consortium, and the issue was not about a race at all, although it's presented that way, but it was about whether the data was going to be kept private and paid for by fee-paying subscribers, which would have meant that it was only available to scientists in developed countries virtually, or was it going to be freely and publicly available, which is what our consortium wanted to achieve. We had to make it into a race, because if we hadn't got the data out in short order, then there would have been intellectual property constraints which would have prevented us doing so. So we had to sort of join in the race, and then of course it became hyped up in a media event.
The genome was then published in 2000 as the first draft, and 2003 in more complete draft, and that information is available freely. But there are still problems with patenting of genes, human genes.
Yes, very much so. There's a trick which has been used by the patent offices both in America and in Europe to pretend that when a gene is removed from the human body, or copied, because it's not removed physically, but when it's copied into a test tube version, normally sitting in a bacterium, that somehow it's not the same thing and you can now patent it. And that is simply not the case. I mean, it's a falsehood. It's the same information precisely. And so this is wrong, but it's been used through the courts to put patent holds on more than a quarter of human genes now. This is something which is maybe beginning to unravel. There's been a recent court case in America, very exciting, where two key genes, which are generating a lot of money for their patent owners, Myriad, were knocked down. But of course, there will be appeals. This will drag on through the courts for a long time. But for all sorts of reasons to do with not only with the commercialization and excessive pricing that you get as a result of the patents, but also for freedom of communication between scientists in future research, important stuff. If you can't use things freely, freely, I think we really do need to try and roll this patenting business back and keep it not to such a large item as a whole human gene, which you cannot invent around, but rather to specific processes which come out of this, specific pieces of kit, for example, for doing diagnostics, where it's perfectly reasonable to have patenting. But you should not have patenting on whole chunks as a human gene.
How would patenting of genes affect me as a health consumer? I mean, it sounds to me like it's a problem for researchers if they want to use these genes in certain ways. But if I want therapeutics or whatever from a hospital, does that affect me as well?
Well, if we allow things to continue, it will make things a great deal more expensive. I would also say, you know, if it's affecting researchers to any extent, it's going to reduce or rather increase the time that's taken for you to get a cure. It's simply not the case that patents accelerate research. I think that's a falsehood. But there is one example of very high pricing, which fortunately we've pushed back in Europe. But American women are still having to pay something like $4,000 for familial breast cancer testing. This is simply not available to the poorer quarter or so of American women who don't have health insurance, and they simply have no way of checking whether they have these faulty genes or not, and are therefore liable to die of breast cancer. And this seems to me absolutely iniquitous.
You can join our Facebook group if you look for the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. There you can chat with other listeners, post comments, laugh at our photos, and all that stuff. Do pregnant women living near mobile phone masts increase their unborn child's risk of developing cancer in later life? A study on nearly 4,000 children, published in the British Medical Journal last week, found no link. We followed the reactions and analysis of the story with our story tracker. Robin, you've been looking at this. Just run us through the basics of the story first.
Right, this is a piece of research from Imperial College in London. And they identified 1,397 children under the age of five who had been diagnosed with leukemia or a tumour of the brain or of the central nervous system between 1999 and 2001. They then compared each child with four children of the same gender born on the same day but who had not developed cancer. They then looked at the distance of the mother's home at the time of birth of these children from a phone mast. They also took into fact the total power output from the base stations and the power density for base stations, and found no pattern that suggested the children of mums living near a base station during pregnancy had a greater risk of developing cancer than those who lived elsewhere.
So this study was published in the British Medical Journal last week, and we've spent the next few days sort of following up for reaction and analysis and comments from blogs and newspapers, various other places around the internet, and collected them together in one place. So on the day itself, of course, there was the main newspapers around the world actually did cover this. Jeremy Lawrence in The Independent pointed out that the number of handsets has increased from 1997 to 2007, from 9 million handsets to 74 million. So there's a lot of mobile phone use. And of course, everyone listening probably has a mobile phone. And so there is this long-term concern that perhaps this stuff is causing some sort of cancer or raising risks of cancer. So far, no studies have been conclusive enough, perhaps because of the fact that we've only been using phones for a decade or so, and maybe these cancers take a long time to actually show up.
Well, by and large, most people who are in this field of research consider this a fairly well done study, and you know, it's not flaky, though there are some questions that have been raised about the actual funding of this study, funded by an independent body called the UK Mobile Telecommunications Health Research Programme, which was set up, and it's jointly funded, we should note, by the UK Department of Health and the mobile telecommunications industry. I don't, you know, there is that issue that it is partly funded by the industry, and you know, a few people have blogged in saying, well, you know, what about this, which is a fair point.
And Cancer Research UK also posted some data last week looking at the rates of malignant brain tumors, which actually in the UK have remained stable for the past 10 years. So, you know, another feather of evidence to suggest that actually there isn't much to be concerned about so far.
No, exactly, so far. I think those, as you know, who knows what the lag in use of mobile phones might be if there is a link with brain cancer.
I was interested in the kind of quality of the debate going on in the comments underneath this story of people exchanging kind of opinions and data.
But there are some more interesting blogs actually coming out from the Institution of Engineering and Technology, for example, has a position statement on the biological effects of electromagnetic radiation. And you can imagine that they'd be interested in this because a lot of their members are developing this technology. So they have this thing called the Biological Effects Policy Advisory Group. And Tony Barker, who's a fellow of the IET and chairman of that group I just mentioned, said that obviously there's a lot of interest in whether exposure to mobile phones and electricity pylons has harmful health effects. And of course, there's lots of anecdotal evidence to suggest that's the case. But the position of most scientific bodies, including the Institution of Engineering and Technology, has remained substantially the same, and that there's no persuasive evidence. And the absence of robust new evidence on the harmful effects over the past 2 years has sort of, you know, strengthened their case.
That's quite interesting. The survey that came out on Thursday that was talking about some 46% of Europeans still concerned or very concerned or fairly concerned about the health risks of electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah, this is the Eurobarometer survey on electromagnetic fields, which, yeah, as you said, nearly half of Europeans are very or fairly concerned about the health risks of electromagnetic fields. Again, it's one of these things that's going to be hard to shift, Robin.
Well, it depends what you mean by concern. They were concerned when they were asked the question, but probably forgot the question 2 minutes later.
When they're on their phone.
when they're on their phone. Yeah, I mean, you're right. Depends how you define the word concern. I think we should all be concerned, but at the moment there's no evidence, therefore we shouldn't be worried.
So there's a difference between concerned and worried.
Oh, definitely, don't you think?
Okay. Interesting. No, I see that.
Well, all that story is being tracked on our website. If you go to guardian.co.uk/science, that'll continue to be updated if we find any new bits and pieces this week as well. You can add your own contribution to our story tracker at guardian.co.uk/science. And we've got a whole bunch of Twitter handles as well if you want to follow various bits of the science coverage here. So the story trackers themselves are at story tracker. This podcast is at Science Weekly, and the rest of the Guardian Science content is at Guardian Science. That's it for this week's show. Thanks to Nell Bowes and Robin McKee. Also, the BBC's David Shookman. His book, Reporting Live from the End of the World, is out now. By the way, something else to look out for audio-wise on our website this week is the annual Sense About Science lecture. Editor of the British Medical Journal, Fiona Godley, talks us through why we need to be standing up for science all over again. And she also talks about conflicts of interest in drug trials. It's fascinating stuff. You should listen to it. Listen to that at senseaboutscience.org.uk. And also, we'll put up a link on our blog too. In the studio next week, we've got the brother of the man who invented the World Wide Web. I hope our modem's working. Yes, Mike Berners-Lee will tell us about the carbon footprint of everything. Plus, a piece of music composed using DNA coding. We just provide you with a relentless stream of fascinating noise about science. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by a very flowery-shirted Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. It's like CCCCGG, CCCCGG, CCCCGGT. Is that what it is? No?
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.